is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Susie Bright. She's the author of a memoir called Big Sex, Little Death. Hi, Susie. How are you?
Hi, David. It's great to talk with you.
It's great to talk with you. I do want to, you know, I love this book. I mean, partly it's because it's about a period of time that's very vivid for me that I grew up in, as you did. I was really struck by a number of things about your life that I learned that I didn't know. I've known you in professional connections, but there's a lot of stuff in here about your personal life and things that you have done that were new to me. And I guess with my first question is, what prompted you to write a memoir?
Well, it's a kind of book I've always enjoyed reading from other people. You know, I grew up reading autobiographies, memoirs, biographies, thinking about who my heroes were. I remember scoffing when I would see a memoir written by someone who I thought was way too young, And I thought, well, one of the things that you get to enjoy when you get older is you can finally write your memoir. And sure enough, as time went by, more people started being curious about me. I mean, this is my 31st book, and you know I've been an activist and a blabbermouth for a long time. And people would say, you know, where do you come from? Were you raised by wolves? Was it a convent? You know, like, what's the deal with you?
How did you get this way?
Yes. Did you pop out of your father's head like Zeus? You know, like, what happened? So in some ways, I was just responding to a question that was hanging up there. And I finally felt like I had the perspective. And I think I started writing this when I was 50. I'm 53 now. My parents had just passed away within 18 months of each other. And there's a lot of things you find out about your ancestors and about what went into your young life after your parents die. You find it out. You know, you thought you knew it all. You know, I thought I'd been a real nosy Parker and that I had explored my family's history. But there are some things you will never know until certain people pass away, and it's like a rolling away of the stone.
No, that's true. And there's a lot in here about your parents. I think obviously that means you dedicated the book to them. You know, they were pretty important to you, as I guess they are to everybody. But in certain ways, maybe the missing things that weren't there, the difficulties you had, I don't want to dwell on that necessarily, but it obviously did shape you as a person. You had this complex relationship between your parents and, there were times when you were with one and not the other. So do you feel like you're, it's sort of, maybe it is trite to ask this, but I mean, do you feel like that early experience shaped your personality in significant ways?
Well, the one thing that I considered as I began to write this was that I had always thought I was the big radical in the family. And, I was always sort of coming to them and saying, guess what? You know, guess what I'm doing now? I've just had sex. I'm going to commie camp. I'm seizing state power in 5 minutes. What are you doing? I thought I was, just the last word in radical behavior. But the more I listened to them and the more we talked and I was able to understand their lives, I realized that they had done things in their generation that were so powerfully transformative. I will never do what they did. They were the first to go to college. My mother didn't die in childbirth. That was a big deal in the Halloran family. She married someone who wasn't a Catholic, an Irish Catholic. I mean, you can't imagine how shocking that was. And then that they got a divorce. I mean, it was like the end of the world getting a divorce back then. It was so difficult. You had to sue each other and say that it was, extreme cruelty.
No, that's true. I think it is. I think it's not uncommon that we sort of find out that things were not the way the history has made us think about those periods. That people were still they were having sex, they were thinking politically, there were all kinds of really interesting things going on. So obviously your parents were part of that. And your father was an anthropologist, which I, or right, and I thought that was very interesting to me because,
Well, not just anthropology. He was the first linguist to receive a doctorate at UC Berkeley. My parents met in Berkeley right after the war. They were both studying this field called linguistics. Nobody even knew what that meant. It was so new. It was so different. They went off to India. I hope you laughed at one chapter in my book. There's a little picture of the two of them looking like Dr. Livingston and Nell when they first got off the boat in India.
I'm looking at that. Actually, I had the book open exactly to that page as you were saying that. And it's a,
So they
and a,
were.
it's a, and they look like that could be 1967.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. They're pretty. They look. They're not at all hippies in that picture. They look so quaint. They were part of an intellectual movement that was happening in Northern California at that time that produced the Left Coast, the whole concept of the Left Coast poetry, literature, the Beatnik movement, certainly the civil rights movement. They were both powerfully influenced by that. The pacifist and anti-war movement, all of these things were in the air. They were powerfully moved by them. And when I was a little girl, I think the first song I ever listened to on a record player was We Shall Overcome. I mean, this was it was in my baby bottle.
Right. No, I think that sort of comes through. And then what there's this other thing that it was really important to your life that I wasn't aware of at all was this thing called Red Tide, the high school magazine and kind of leftist organizing magazine that w you were part of and the movement as it were.
Well, that was an interesting thing in the 70s. A lot of junior high and high school students were involved in trying to get the 18-year-old vote. You have no idea how many 14-year-olds worked on the 18-year-old vote campaign. And we were also very excited about ending the war, and we wanted to be older. We wanted to be in the middle of things like all the college students were, but we were frustrated because, we were at the beginning of puberty and stuck at home with our parents. And in high school, there was a group of us. I mean, they were yippies, anarchists, pot dealers, feminists, queer libbers. I mean, it was just every radical kid on campus was part of this newspaper called The Red Tide. And we did everything from protest Nixon to the school cafeteria food. We would have events like Women's Week, which was going to be lesbians and birth control and self-defense training. And we, everything that we could think of, that the way we wanted to transform not only our high school, but our entire lives was part of this newspaper. And this was in the days when there was no digital anything. We wrote everything, then we had to typeset it. We had to wax it down. It was an old-fashioned web press. People would come look at us and say, "Who's the evil adult who's behind you?" And there was no one. It was just us.
And that was a pretty, I mean, it was a pretty important period of your life, I think. You
Oh
went
yeah,
to
it was. I mean, we were frequently arrested, suspended, expelled. I ended up being the plaintiff and suing the school board for the right to distribute our newspaper without them interfering. And essentially, it was saying, you know what? Minors have First Amendment rights too. You cannot shut us up. And it was a really, like powerful ACLU case of that period. But I, in the meantime, as you saw in the book, I got impatient. I just felt like, hey, the world needs to change now, and I'm stuck in high school. I've got to get out of here.
Right. So then and of course, that was a period when things seemed to be more open, in that way. There wasn't. It was. I think the 70s were. And really, this idea that there was the 60s is kind of silly because that whole period really extended into the 70s and later. All of that activism and counterculturalism of the 60s was really taking place in the 70s.
Yeah, at the time, I felt like I'd missed it all. I mean, I literally would cry in my pillow because I felt like I could see it slipping away. The turn to Reaganism was coming, and I would get so frustrated about how apathetic some of my fellow students were. And now I just have to smile because by comparison, we had a pretty activist high school. But I kept thinking, damn it, I was in diapers in the 60s and I've missed all the fun.
Right, but then you got to be participate in and actually be a part of the great sexual and political liberation period of the 80s.
Yeah, who'd have thunk?
That's right. Well, maybe we should talk about that a little bit. I mean, that's obviously something that you're pretty famous for, which is on the lesbian magazine On Our Backs, which was, as you know, as we all, as I guess a lot of people know, I'm not sure everybody today remembers it, but a kind of shocking openness to sexuality that had been somewhat missing, I think, from a lot of the cultural milieu of that period.
Well,
And
the way that got started is different than how I understood it when I wrote the memoir. In the beginning, I'm part of a group of women who were really upset at the conservative direction that some feminists were going in, who wanted to eliminate erotic expression and just kind of put on an iron chastity belt, for the duration. And on the other hand, when we looked at popular culture and how they presented women and lesbians in particular, it was so sexist and ridiculous and so inauthentic. It had nothing to do with what real lesbian sex lives looked like. We decided, we're going to do our own magazine, and we had a sense of humor. We were very cheeky. We were very impudent, but we also wanted to talk about sexual issues that we felt like were completely silenced in the mainstream as well as in the feminist press at the time. So off we go. We start On Our Backs. And what I didn't realize until years and years later was that not only was it the first lesbian sex magazine, it was the first magazine produced by women about anything, let alone sex. We were the first people to use, the first publishers of any kind to use the desktop publishing platform. When Steve Jobs created all this stuff, he hoped someday someone would use it. Well, we just said, we'll use it right now. Thank you very much. We didn't have any money. We were desperate to cut costs. And so we were the first to get an Apple and produce our magazine on the screen and go to press just like that. No one had ever done that before. And we didn't understand that at the time. At the time, we thought we were just having this incredibly cranky faction fight in the feminist world where a lot of women were saying, you should have never done this. How dare you? You're ruining everything. But it turned out to be much more historic than I even realized.
Well, no, I think that's an interesting point that you were a precursor then of what I think is going on now, which is another opening of technology or another opportunity for people to take advantage of the technological tools for publishing and self-expression. It's being redefined completely now. But On Our Backs lasted about 7 years, if I remember right. It was a pretty, I mean, but it, and I, it, you, it, when it ended, it was not a pretty sight, and you talk about that in the book.
Well,
It.
there was a couple of different phases. I was there. We started working on it in 83. The first issue came out in 84, and I left at the end of 1990, beginning of 91. At that point, it went through a succession of owners, and I can't even tell you what it looked like during those years because I couldn't bring myself to look at it. I was so upset that it had fallen apart at the seams. But yeah, it was not, I don't know. We were so, I don't suppose any business enjoys going bankrupt, but we also didn't have a clue how to handle the financial burdens that we faced. And we also weren't prepared for the prejudice. Not just, I mean, on one hand, the people we thought were going to be our sisters were banning us from their bookstores. Then in the mainstream world of magazine publishing, it was, you were dealing with the mafia all the time. Nobody would do anything unless you paid them off. There was, you know, or you would get this, like, what's a nice girl doing in a business like this? You know, we were told we couldn't get insurance, that we couldn't open a bank account, that we couldn't have a credit card. You know, things that every business wants. We were told that because of the nature of our business, we could not be part of this. And it was just, it was shocking. We had to pay a premium to get our magazine published. There was one place in town that if you paid through the nose, they'd do it. And everyone else acted like we were beyond the pale. And I would say, why are you saying this? Robert Mapplethorpe is being exhibited at the Whitney, and you're telling us we can't publish on our backs? It was enraging all the time.
Yeah, I remember that. But it also got you started in another, you know, in your book publishing world.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Shortly after I left on our backs, I got my first phone call from a mainstream New York publisher at the time, Macmillan. And this fellow said, I've been told you know more about contemporary American erotic literature than anyone else alive. And I was like, whoa. If that's true, that's terrible, but I'll take it. I'll take that compliment. And it was an editor who asked me if I would do a Best American Erotica series to complement the Best American Poetry series that they already had going. And I said to him, that's a fantastic idea. The one thing I would want to make sure is that you really are up for the task, because I will want to publish the very best people. I don't care what the subject is. I don't care if it's gay or straight. I don't even want to think about it in terms of labels like that. I just want the best writing that features compelling sexuality in its content. And I want to show off the greats. You know, I want it to be the Nobel Prize winners. And they said yes. And that series went for 15 years. Really remarkable.
Yeah. When you also did Herotica?
Yeah. I've been a busy little bee, haven't I?
Well, yeah. No, if you look at it, I mean, when you're talking about whether, you know, is somebody's life enough for a memoir, I was thinking about the amount of stuff that you've done when you break it out. It's a lot of stuff, and it's, you know, you have a lot to talk about. I guess the other thing that was really interesting to me about this book, and I assume this was, you know, done on purpose, that there really isn't that much sex in the book. It's not about sex. It's about life and sexuality and politics. But you know, if you're expecting it to be a whole bunch of, you know, this is Susie's sex life, that's not what it is.
Well, you know, I don't know whether you're jaded or everyone else is naive, or I would love to put you in a room with the people who have reviewed this book, including people like the Library Journal, who was like, this is not for the faint of heart or the prudish. It's wall-to-wall sex. And then I've had the people who've said, there's not enough lesbian sex in it. And then I've had the people who've said, there is too much lesbian sex, you know, and I want to know about her relationship with the man in her life. And I feel like it says more about them than it says about me. I certainly wanted to write, it's not a stroke book. It's a memoir, and it covers a lot of turning points in my life. And when sexuality comes at a transitional point in the story, it's part of the narrative. It's part of the plot. But it's not chapter 5. Today, I went to bed with so-and-so. Last night, I stooped, you know, the neighbor. I mean, it's not Penthouse Letters.
No, then I guess that's, maybe I am jaded, but it just didn't feel like, I guess that says something about me. But I
yes.
didn't read it, you
yes,
know, I didn't.
It does, David. What can I say to shock you?
Probably that there isn't enough sex in the book. No, I don't know. That it was just I thought it was I was struck by the fact that you didn't dwell on, sexual adventurism. It was much more about, it's integrated into your life, and maybe that is, the key to the story, that it's your life is not defined by sex. It's just part of your life. It's integrated into what you do, and you're a whole person. And I think there is a this sort of maybe the misunderstanding that people have when they think about sex is that that's a form of objectification of sex, is to think about it as purely on its own and not as part of the fabric of someone's life.
I think one thing I've noticed, and I wrote a bit about this in my introduction, and I've been editorializing on the subject of male memoirs versus female. When a man writes a novel with a strong, frank, sexual elements in it, and we could talk about, the famous ones like Henry Miller, Philip Roth, John Updike, Norman Mailer. I mean, those were the big dudes in the 60s and 70s. No one ever said, "He's a sex writer." Like, "Oh my God, he's a sex writer. Are you a sexpert, Mr. Mailer?" I mean, no. No one would ever say that in a million years. But if a woman writes a memoir and she highlights anything at all sexual, there's this real virgin versus whore number that goes on, like, are you a mother or are you a sex pot? Well, you can't be both. Make up your mind. Which is it going to be? And the cliches about, what does your life consist of or what niche should we put you in? I have to fight my way out of that box. I'm
No, that's true. That's true. I think the sex,
constantly surprised by that.
right, that sexism is, it is funny as the political discourse has changed, and feminism has been absorbed, let's say, in some ways, and we have a kind of feeling that culture has expanded, and that the women's lives are better than they were, which I think is probably true. But I think, to think that somehow there is no differentiation, that there is sexism in the way it's kind of inherently in a lot in what you're describing, that there are values that people are not even realizing that they are using as judgments when they read a book or they see a movie. The sexism is so in unquestioned that it allows that to happen.
Yeah, that's it has been the way of literature in the world. I just keep doing my subversive little thing no matter what.
Well, so
I
maybe
guess I have my own clock that is ticking that doesn't have anything to do with the marketing bell of the times.
just before we go, you could talk a little bit about what you're doing now. Sort of like the, I mean, and that's interesting too, that the book, there's more about the early part of your life. If I sort of looked at this book in terms of number of pages, you don't even get to On Our Backs until more than two-thirds of the way through the book. So there's not as much about your later life in here. Maybe you could just talk for a minute or two about what you're doing now.
Well, for people who are curious about what I did when I grew up, a lot of my books, like Susie Sexpert's Lesbian Sex World, The Sexual State of the Union, Full Exposure, or Mommy's Little Girl, I was always writing autobiographically. And this memoir, I wanted to show the surprises. I mean, I'm glad you said you didn't know a lot of what was in this book, because that's what it was supposed to be like. As for right now, I have been touring the country since early March, and I'll be finishing up in mid-June. So I feel like I'm on this Woody Guthrie meets, Susie Sexpert tour of America, really taking in what's happening politically, economically, how the country is shifting, and some of it's pretty rough. I mean, going to some of the places that were locations of my book, like Detroit, which is a combination of of an abandoned moon colony and Deadwood. That, you know, you could say that a lot about the industrial Midwest.
Yeah, that's true.
I found
So are you?
that a lot of my favorite parts of the book tour, I've been doing a workshop about sex positive parenting, which looks at how raising kids changes your sex life, and it also foretells theirs. I mean, you're watching how they grow up and what they're going to be like, and you have some influences and some you don't. And those conversations with people have been some of the most revealing and intimate. I'm definitely going to be writing about what I've learned in these parenting workshops. That's on my to-do list.
Oh, I think that's a great idea. I think what you just described is really interesting. And this, I think that's something that people need to think about. It's also, it's got to be true, and I'm sure that it is, that there's a generational difference in the way that modern parents, if you're in your 20s and 30s, both think about sex, think about their children, think about their relationships, than was true in a prior generation or in a couple of generations farther back. Not to say that it may not be radically different, but I think there are huge differences that you would see, and maybe in you know, as you go around the country talking to people, that you'll be able to learn about. I think it's a great idea.
Well, I'm just going to have to rope you into it. I'm going to put you on the hot seat.
All right, you can interview me another time. That would be fun. but listen, it was great talking to you, Susie. I think we could have done another half an hour, but I know you have to go. So I want to thank you for doing this interview and talking to me about your book, which is called Big Sex, Little Death, a memoir. Susie Bright, the author. I'm David Wilk, a host of Writer's Cast, and thank you very much.